Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about New Subaltern Politics, Reconceptualizing Hegemony and Resistance in Contemporary India. This book is edited by Alf Gunvald Nielsen and Sorella Roy, and is published by Oxford University Press. This book is a wonderfully rich and theoretically coherent collection of texts that critically assess the legacies of subaltern studies through many different pieces of research into political movements in India today. These range from students at elite higher education institutes who shore up their privilege, to queer activism in Calcutta, to Dalit villages who are fighting against land grabs. The book's rich case studies really allow for a nuanced and relational understanding of, you know, what subaltern means, as well as, you know, the relationships between, you know, society and the state. It really is a truly wonderful book, and I had the pleasure of speaking with both Alf and Sorella just a few moments before.
Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Alf and Sorella to the show. Thanks a lot for your wonderful book, and thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having us, Ian.
Oh, yes, great. So before we talk about your book itself, I was wondering, could you just please tell us a little bit about yourselves, your academic backgrounds and interests before this book?
Well, I'm an associate professor of sociology at the University of Bergen in Norway, and I've worked for a number of years studying social movements and other forms of subaltern politics in India. And I also have a side interest, a side business in social movements research more generally, which I've also written quite a bit about.
I'm currently senior lecturer in sociology at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. My primary research is broadly in gender and sexual politics, much of which takes as its starting point the contemporary history of India and South Asia. And that's most represented in my monograph called Remembering Revolution, Gender Violence and Political Subjectivity in India's Naqshbandi Movement.
Wonderful. That's great. So the book we're talking about, it's New Subaltern Politics, Reconceptualizing Hegemony and Resistance in Contemporary India. It's a collection, a really wonderful collection. I really enjoyed reading it. But before we turn to the case studies itself, I thought a first big question so that we can frame this discussion here today. So my first question to you is, you know, what is subaltern politics? What makes the type of politics that you discuss in this edited volume new? Which is in your title, and how does it relate to the, you know, existing scholarship on subaltern studies?
Right. Well, we define subaltern politics very broadly as the various forms of political activity that's pursued by social groups, which can be said to be adversely incorporated into intersecting sets of power relations, such as caste, gender, and class. This political activity obviously takes a number of forms. So it ranges from everyday forms of resistance via rights-based campaigns, all the way up to armed struggle in contemporary India. Its newness derives, in a sense, not only from the fact that it's contemporary, sort of ongoing as we talk about it now and as we were writing the book, but also the fact that it's situated, in a sense, in certain ongoing processes of change in the Indian context. On the one hand, the long unraveling of Nehruvian developmentalism and the ways in which subaltern groups were accommodated within the political economy of that formation. On the other hand, the contradictions of neoliberal reform in India and the many conflicts that neoliberalism has both thrown up and the possibilities of new forms of politics generated within that, well, that cauldron, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And in terms of subaltern studies, what we both found over a number of years working on this topic was, of course, that when you work on new forms of subaltern politics in India, whether it's large-scale social movements or NGOs or more sort of the quotidian politics of how subaltern groups relate to the state, it's almost impossible not to enter into dialogue with the analytical templates and methodological debates that were central to the subaltern studies project, despite the fact that it was initially a project that concentrated on colonial history. The ways in which you approach, in a sense, the study of politics from below has remained very influential, and that's what we try to sort of address in this book.
That's wonderful. And how did this volume come about, and what was the idea behind it? How did you organize this collection and the authors and so on, and what made you think of these themes?
So the volume came about through a series of conference panels and workshops that Alf and I organized when we were both at the time working at the University of Nottingham in the UK. And basically, the panels and the workshops were meant to represent some of the newer forms of subaltern politics in contemporary India, and that we knew various colleagues were researching, and to think through how we can bring these empirical instances together under a common theoretical rubric. And as Alf just said, that it was also very clear to us that those of us who were actively mapping these forms of oppositional politics in India were doing so in active dialogue with the analytical and methodological frames provided by the original Subaltern Studies project, which suggested the continuing relevance of this project, even if as a foil to disagree with or depart from. Mm-hmm. Now, while we laid out the chapters as they appear, it was actually only in the review process and thanks to the recommendations of a very helpful referee that the three concrete subsections and headings emerged as they are. And I think these very much organically reflect the volume's endeavor to firstly recover and remobilize Gramsci for the present. Secondly, to argue with and against Partha Chatterjee's influential framing of Indian politics. And finally, to extend the scope of the category of subaltern politics itself and forms of political agency that were originally not considered under within its ambit to the instances of involving religion, emotion, affect, and textuality.
Thank you. And I think it really is a wonderful collection because of its diversity, but also because it really has a theoretical coherence that runs through the chapters. So let's turn to the chapters themselves. The first chapter is the most theoretical. This is your chapter, Alf, and this is the first one that comes after the introduction. So this extends some of these theoretical concerns that you discuss in the introduction, and specifically you talk about the state. So I was wondering, could you please give us an overview about how sort of state-society relations have been conceptualized, usually in subaltern studies, as well as these more recent ethnographies of the state that you discuss, before telling us a little bit about what your reading of Gramsci adds to the discussion?
Well, I start from the observation that the Subaltern Studies project has theorized state-society relations in terms of a foundational schism that, in a sense, extends from Ranjit Guha's paradigmatic statement that subaltern politics constitutes an autonomous domain. Now, the schism in question is that between subaltern life worlds and subaltern politics on the one hand and the state on the other, and this extends across historical time. So if you read various contributions to the Subaltern Studies project, you'll see that they argued in a sense that the pre-colonial state was found as fundamentally remote from the rural life worlds of subaltern groups. You'll find that the argument was made that the colonial state, for all its efforts to overcome, in a sense, the distance that existed between subjects and rulers, failed to do this beyond incorporating a minority elite into the running of the colonial state. And you'll also find that the argument is made that the post-colonial state has indeed done very little to overcome this dichotomy, in a sense, between subaltern life worlds and the state. I also think that this idea of a schism is there in Partha Chatterjee's current work on political society. True enough, Chatterjee argues that over the past three decades, the Indian state has extended its reach quite extensively into rural communities and has become something, an entity that the peasantry, for one, interacts with, but it's nevertheless sort of the idea of a schism is nevertheless introduced through the back door by saying that subaltern groups, when they mobilize politically, operate strictly on the terrain of political society and that civil society remains an elite domain. So my sort of my point of entry into this debate has been to say that this analytical template doesn't add up. I mean, even if you look at pre-colonial forms of peasant protest, you will see that these are very often centered on making an appeal to moral economies of rule that which suggests that there was indeed a relationship between rulers and subjects, between pre-colonial forms of state and peasant life worlds, and that these were central in a sense to the ways in which subaltern groups claimed legitimacy for their opposition. If you look at the colonial world or colonial India, you'll see, for example, that tribal groups or Adivasis, when they mobilized in large-scale political rebellions, they very often mobilized colonial idioms of state-making to justify their revolts and to frame their claims. And certainly present-day mobilization in rural India, which has been my focus, is very much predicated around making democratic claims upon the state, which suggests that the dichotomy between civil and political society doesn't go far enough in terms of reconceptualizing state-society relations. So one advance that has been developed in recent scholarship, for example, that of Aradhana Sharma and also Gupta's work, is draws on Foucault's idea of governmentality and argues that subaltern claims and claims making proceeds through institutions and idioms and technologies of rule that are linked in different ways to the post-colonial states. Now, my argument is that these perspectives have done a lot to overcome the kind of dichotomic thinking that is so paradigmatic of the Subaltern Studies project, but it's nevertheless marred by its failure to, in a sense, conceptualize the way in which state power is congealed from and simultaneously also then reproduces structures of power based on caste, class, and so on over time. So historical structures of power. And what I try to do in my chapter is to say that, or argue that, if we revert back to Gramsci and his perspective on state formation, and specifically modern state formation, his argument is in a sense that hegemony is constructed in and through the making of the modern states, and especially by building a organic link between what he defines in a very different way from what Chatterjee does as civil and political society. The fusion of the two constructs what he refers to as an organic passage between subaltern and dominant groups, which enable, in a sense, then the dominant groups to elicit the consent of subalterns. And this is then key to the reproduction over time of foundational structures of power. So I try to mobilize Gramsci's ideas of state formation to add on to the relational thinking that has been developed in what I refer to as Foucauldian ethnographies of state power in India. And I do that with a specific purpose in mind, which is to try and enable a discussion of how specific forms of state and specific constellations of state power in India simultaneously enables and constrains subaltern politics in the sense that there will be openings where oppositional politics can be pursued. But precisely because of the way in which state power enables dominant groups to act in certain ways which subaltern groups can't, due to the way that state power limits the advances that subaltern groups can make, it's also necessary to think beyond the state when you think strategy and so on. So those are, some of the key arguments that I pursue in my chapter.
Wonderful. Thanks for that. It's a really, really concise overview of that very, theoretically dense chapter. Thank you so much for that. Let's stick with this, the first section now, and let's turn to one of the case studies in detail. I was wondering, could one of you please tell me a little bit about Ajanta Subramanian's chapter, which is on the Indian Institute of Technology in Madras? And this chapter, I think, is really interesting because it pushes us to think about what you've been talking now about autonomy, but also homogeny of certain groups in a different way. So could you please tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Ajanta's chapter shows how the idea of merit is a key way in which caste privilege is displaced and reproduced. And this is obviously very important in the context of Tamil Nadu, where the reassertion of upper caste privilege can be looked at in terms as being a direct response to a very successful Dalit movement that has won considerable concessions in terms of state policies of reservation. The discourse of merit enables a representation of the space of technical education or the IITs as being autonomous and thus renders a caste hegemony invisible. And it's this intersection of autonomy and hegemony is what Ajanta shows in effect as being at stake in the IITs, which remain dominated, she shows, by upper caste groups, but presented as being autonomous of caste interests. And I don't know if you've seen, but she's been recently writing in the mainstream media, in the Indian magazine Open, for instance, about recent caste-based controversies involving IIT Madras, and how, again, in the mainstream press, the IITs are represented as being, you know, free of any kind of caste conflict. I think the chapter is also significant because of its focus on elite and not marginalized groups alone. And this case study, in effect, goes into the heart of one of the volume's central purposes, which is to establish subalternity as a relationship between elite and marginalized groups, as opposed to simply thinking of the subaltern as an identity category which pertains to marginalized groups alone. And the reproduction of hegemony has to be located in this relationship, which is obviously never one that is free of conflict or contest.
Wonderful, thank you. So let's now move on to the middle section of the book. This is like three wonderful discussions which you pull together under the title Imagination, Faith, Effect. And let's turn to your chapter, Strella, which is a section about queer activism, and specifically this organization, SAFO, which is a lesbian lesbian organization in Kolkata. So I was wondering, what is the work of this organization teach us about the way politics are done in India today? And what's the role of effect in this?
Okay, so I think the very emergence of an organization like SAFO that provides support for and advocates on behalf of queer women tells us a lot about a changing landscape of politics in India today, which has been made possible by particular configurations such as neoliberalism, globalization, and indeed the transnationalization of gender and sexual rights work. It's also illustrative of the fact that the outcomes of these kind of configurations cannot be anticipated in advance, insofar as the public emergence of rights and advocacy around sexuality was made possible by funding for HIV/AIDS, right? So that has been one of the inadvertent possibilities, this kind of new form of politicization around sexuality previously unseen in India. So SAFO, an organization like SAFO, is a product of this recent history, but I also want to say that it bears the markers of a much longer history, which is of the Indian women's movement. And lesbian groups in particular, you know, have always been in conversation with the Indian women's movement and have had quite a troubled history. So in the first instance, I think, you know, an organization like SAFO and the work that it does shows how the politics of the present is a product of both older legacies and newer modalities. And I've written quite a bit about this in another article elsewhere. I think SAFO also provides is insight into the ways in which younger people are being politicized today, and not in a narrow sense, simply around sexual identity, but much more broadly, given particularly how SAFO has is very self-aware and has a commitment to broader progressive politics. So as I say in my chapter, you know, an organization like SAFO very typically represents self-identified lesbian women who are, you know, anywhere from the age group of from their early 20s to their mid 40s. They are middle class, but they're certainly not elite, or rather, you know, they're variations in terms of middle classness within the group, and who are, you know, actively in the process of constituting themselves as being queer, but also, you know, constituting themselves as young people in neoliberal India in a variety of ways. And finally, what I argue in the chapter is how this politics is really about affect and is an affective politics, which is a term that I take from Naisargi Dave's recent book on lesbian politics in India. And by which I mean very simply that, you know, this is a politics that you cannot understand if you don't see it as being motivated by a locus of desire, feeling, bodily forces, conscious or unconscious, directed to, I think I would say, willing into existence something that does not exist, namely lesbian identity. I mean, Dawe makes this point in her book, and I would restate it, that obviously the possibility of being lesbian in India actually does not exist. So it's how do you will into existence something that does not exist, something that is still unintelligible in many ways. But what I also show very interestingly in the context of Sappho is how affect, or, this repertoire of feeling and forces, is policed in certain ways in how Sappho tries to carve out for itself a properly political space. And it's very interesting to me how, after this chapter was written and published, very recently, in fact, on Sappho's Facebook page, there has been a number of tensions around people posting on the page as if it were a dating site, so actively soliciting, other members, and then the admin responding by saying, we're not a dating site, and this page is for political reasons, and you can't use this as a space for dating. And that is, that's the kind of tension that the chapter explores, and which I see constantly. That the organization is constantly having to battle with this, this tension between what is political and then how affect is actually, how this politics is affective, but trying to direct that, trying to police that in certain ways. And I think queer politics in particular, struggles with this tension in ways that other forms of subaltern politics doesn't. So I think the case of Sappho, the work it does, and my research suggests how it really expands our sense of what is conventionally political in very, very interesting, creative, and difficult ways.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Let's move on then to the final three chapters of the book, and they all critically assess Chatterjee's work, this distinction that we've already mentioned between political and civil society. The first chapter, I think it's the first chapter, is mm-hmm. Louisa Sturr's chapter, and she talks about the case of, in Tamil Nadu again, this is land taken from Dalit villages to build a tire factory. And she uses this case to critically assess some of Chatterjee's ideas on agrarian transition. So I was wondering, could you please tell me a little bit about the case and also what it tells us about how and why subaltern groups mobilise?
Yeah, certainly. And I think that the place to start is by considering what Chatterjee's intervention here has been about, and why it's become so central, in a sense, to scholarly debates about subaltern politics in India. And his article, Democracy and Economic Transformation in India, addresses one of the main axes of conflict in the country today, which is that of land acquisition. So as a consequence of neoliberal reform, we see struggles over land multiplying. And this is a direct result, of course, of the liberalization of the Indian economy, which causes an influx of investment, which drives processes of primitive accumulation, which the state actively facilitates by enabling land acquisition and so on. But the central tension that Chatterjee points to is, of course, that at the same time as the state facilitates land acquisition, facilitates primitive accumulation, precisely because the state is a democratic entity which needs to secure its legitimacy in relationship to subaltern groups as well, it needs to implement policies that reverses the social consequences of primitive accumulation. So you see various forms of resettlement policies, compensation policies, and so on. And Chatterjee's argument, in effect, is that the new politics of rural India is very much about negotiating those policies. So Louisa's intervention is an attempt, and a very interesting one at that, to both think with Chatterjee and beyond Chatterjee in relationship to a land struggle that took place in the Dalit community in Tamil Nadu. And she makes three interrelated arguments, the first of which is interesting because it calls into question one of Chatterjee's assumptions, namely that moving from the countryside to the city is an attractive option for most subaltern groups in rural India today. Now, what Louisa shows in relationship to this case is that Dalit villagers had come to realize through their own relatively bitter experiences that life in the city, life in urban India, isn't necessarily all that it's cracked up to be. And as a result of that, as a result of their disillusionment with urban life, had come to reassess the countryside as a site where dignified lives could be built around agriculture. They articulated what Louisa refers to as a Dalit claim to agriculture. And it's this that, in a sense, creates the conflict with the tire company that's trying to acquire land here, the fact that people were not willing to move away. So when they started to assert themselves, and this takes us to the second claim, and it points to precisely the problematic nature of Chatterjee's proposition that subaltern groups today articulate their politics strictly in the domain of political society, that is, strictly in relation to bureaucratic categories, governmental categories, rather than democratic idioms and democratic processes. So what Louisa shows is that when Dalits started mobilizing in this village, they started mobilizing on the terrain of local democracy, mobilizing in relationship to the panchayat in the village and making claims, fundamentally democratic claims, around the land acquisition process on that arena. So what we see here in this case study is the way in which subaltern politics traverses back and forth, in a sense, the divide between political society and civil society. So the establishment of these as watertight compartments just doesn't hold up. And it also testifies, in a sense, to how important the local scale, the panchayat, is in terms of democratic politics in India today. There's an awful lot going on there. It's a very important arena of subaltern assertion. So there was an attempt then to bring the local panchayat under democratic control, and this throws up also some interesting questions about what rural subaltern politics is all about today. And the third and final point relates to the question of why this mobilization ultimately failed. I mean, very often when we study subaltern politics, it's important to bear in mind that we're studying groups who are mobilizing against very adverse odds. And that means that very often the mobilizations don't succeed. And some of the more politically relevant questions that we can ask, of course, pertains to why exactly a certain strategy failed. Now, Chatterjee's argument is that the Indian state, in a sense, offers subaltern groups a stake in the neoliberal project through their various policies of compensation, resettlement, rehabilitation, and so on. What Louisa does is to show that it's more complex than that. It's not just about offering subaltern groups a stake. It's also about the various ways in which the state actively disorganizes and disarticulates, if you will, subaltern politics, partly through, in this case, corporate social responsibility, the various interventions around corporate social responsibility, but also through coercive responses. And I think this is key here, that, and it's also a point that I raise in my chapter, which is that you really see, in a sense, the way in which the state functions as a nodal point for the reproduction of hegemonic power in those moments of coercion, when subaltern groundswells are repressed or in other ways crushed by the violence or the forms of repression by the state. So and we've seen it, of course, in India, in Kalinganaga, we've seen it in Nandigram, we've seen it elsewhere in land struggles quite often, that the state mobilizes its repressive apparatus in response to subaltern claims. So Louisa's argument then is that we have to think beyond simply the idea that the state in India today is capable of deflecting subaltern politics through eliciting consent. Coercion remains an important part of that repertoire. And today, you know, it stretches from military offensives such as Green Hunt or the Indian state's presence in Kashmir and the northeast on one end, to the despicable hounding of Tista Setalvad and the ridiculous policies implemented towards an NGO like Greenpeace, for that matter. I mean, the spectrum is wide, and that's part of the picture here that we're investigating. And I think that what Louisa has done in her chapter and what's also been done by Kenneth Nielsen and Subir Sinha, who's contributed chapters to the same section, is to show that there's a lot to be gained, not just from thinking with Chatterjee and his recent interventions, but also thinking beyond him and exploring those tensions, you know. It's so, and that's that, in a sense, is defining of the entire approach that we've tried to adopt to the Subaltern Studies project in this book. The Subaltern Studies project has, of course, elicited a very polarized response, in a sense. It's almost as if you are obliged to be either for or against it, which is a ridiculous proposition. And what we've tried to do in this book is to explore it in a critical dialogue, which recognizes its key contributions, and at the same time, tries to move beyond its limitations in and through ethnographic explorations of ongoing forms of subaltern politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I think, as I said before, I think he does this really well. So as always with these podcasts, I have, you know, we have this wonderfully rich book with lots of case studies, and I've sort of shot through quite quickly. So I was wondering, you know, there's many chapters we've not had the chance to talk about. There's also this wonderful Afterword by David Arnold. So I was wondering, is there something in particular that you'd like to highlight that I've not yet covered in my questions?
Well, I think David Arnold's Afterword, and actually his very generous participation through the life of this project, shows, you know, as we've been saying, right, through the continued relevance, both and analytically, but also politically, of the Subaltern Studies project and what can be gained from dialogue with it within and beyond the bounds of India. So in South Africa, where I now teach and where this book was first launched, a number of colleagues are very actively using the Subaltern Studies rubric to understand the dynamics of contemporary protest there. And I think this shows just how far the Subaltern Studies project has traveled, but also, and we talked about this a little bit at the launch in Johannesburg, how it can perhaps be thought as the first genuine attempt to theorize from the South.
Wonderful, thank you. So now that this book is out, I was wondering, in your own careers and research, what are the new projects that you're working on, either together or separately?
Well, actually, together, we're just in the process of pulling together, which sort of quite nicely links on with what I said, a special journal issue on thinking of sociology from the South, so kind of global sociology. So we're trying to pull together some pieces of work. And this has partly been facilitated by my quite recent move from, you know, the UK to South Africa and being exposed to very, very interesting and provocative conversations in South Africa, which don't find their way to, you know, our conversations in the North, as it were. But otherwise, my chapter in the book draws on a project that I'm doing on the women's movement, well, rather contemporary feminist politics in India. And this is hopefully, well, in the process of being written up as a monograph. And queer politics forms sort of one site of this project to look at how feminist subjects are being constituted today, and what types of, you know, politics they might be engaged in.
And much like Srila, my own work, in a sense, extends from my contribution to this book. I'm currently putting the conceptual apparatus that I've tried to develop there to work in an analysis of the making of, well, subalternity and simultaneously the contestation of subalternity in Bheel communities, Bheel Adivasi communities in Western India and specifically Western Madhya Pradesh from, well, the early 19th century up to the present, to work in what will hopefully become a monograph, which should be ready about around next year. And you know, in parallel with that, I'm pursuing a quite large-scale research project which seeks to investigate the relationship between state formation and social movements in India from 1920 to the present, looking at how social movements have influenced processes of state formation from the sort of the emergence of mass-based nationalism in India up until the present, and conversely, how the form of the Indian state has defined, in a sense, the arenas in which social movements operate and the extent to which social movements have been able to pursue oppositional projects and deepen democracy in India. So this, and this work is ongoing with postdoctoral researchers as part of a team at the University of Bergen.
Well, wonderful. They all sound like really fascinating projects, so we'll keep our eyes open for them in the future. There's not much more for me to do apart from to thank you both again for coming on the podcast, and thanks again for the chance to talk about your wonderful book.
Thank you, Ian.
Yeah, thank you for your interest in the book.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about New Subaltern Politics by Alf Nielsen and Cirilla Roy. I really enjoyed this book. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you're listening again. All right.